Hello and welcome to One Game at a Time, where this week we look at the early tactics of Australian footy as we track the development of the rules and strategies that make the game the one that we know and love. It's a very, very, very big hello to Ryan Miller, a man who is trying to get his handicap down to single figures, but it still sits at a sort of paltry 13, I suppose. Yeah. How are you hitting him, Ryan?
Not great, I'll be honest, boys. But thanks for bringing it out, mate. That was nice.
No charge.
Yeah, that was good of you. I'm well. Thank you for asking.
It's okay. And early tactics?
I'm excited about tonight. Yeah, we, you know, the way the game's developed, looking at people cheating and doing the wrong thing, that's right up my street.
Particularly on the golf stream.
I'm looking forward to coming up with some ideas.
It's hello and welcome to Finn O'Sullivan.
G'day, gentlemen. Look, I'm really looking forward to this episode as well, especially discussing some bizarre, violent, innovative, and also familiar tactics from the, I guess, from the codification of our game in 1859 into almost, I guess, the VFL era post 1897. And I'm really interested to kind of give a, I guess, moving back to the foundation of the Victorian South Australian rivalry, and I think we can trace back a tactic that kind of
maybe started it all.
Makes it, yeah, absolutely.
You are pumped about tonight.
I'm a little bit pumped.
It's that holiday. Your tan is looking pretty spectacular.
Is it?
I will say that.
Yeah. My watch mark.
Yeah, it's nice.
Yeah, Thanks, man. Thanks for noticing.
So before we come to the meat of our discussion tonight, it's time for a segment that we haven't really done so far. But
new segment.
Yeah, new segment.
New segment.
We call it Mailbag. And each week we ask our listeners out there to take our tactics to task, inquire as to our inaccuracies, and certainly unburden themselves of any annoyances around the game that sort of crop up from time to time, which is kind of what our game does. If you are keen to hit us, you can find us at Origins of Footy, which is our Twitter handle, on the email, that's originsoffooty@gmail.com, or find us on the Facebook, where you can follow us as a friend, and our name is One Game at a Time, and that's the name of the podcast. Thank you to everyone out there in Footyland for doing all of the above. And Ryan, what cropped up for you on the social media this week?
I've been looked after this week, boys. I tell you, Daniel Moylan from Preston has sent in a, well, fair play. He picked up a really sort of innocuous sporting situation, and it happened to be around a sport that is very dear to me. As dear as AFL, that's for sure.
Not golf.
No, it's not golf. That's not dear in any way. So, rugby recently, and it leads into what we're going to talk about tonight with tactics.
Mm.
England and Italy played in the Six Nations recently in rugby, and there was a bit of gamesmanship that went on by the Italians.
Because the Italians aren't notable stars, are they, in rugby? they're minnows, aren't they, in terms of rugby?
I think so, yeah. They're a little bit, I suppose, less successful than some of the home nations, as I know.
Yeah.
But what they did is, they've got an Irish coach who came up with a brilliant idea where they refused to adhere to the rules of an offside line. Now, this sounds pretty complicated, but basically what they did is that when someone was tackled, they refused to go and contest possession.
So if we can imagine, from Italy's got the ball,
yep,
runs, is tackled by an English opponent.
Yes.
And then what happens?
Well, if the ball came back really, really quickly, they'd pick the ball up and play on. But if England were going to win the ball, instead of contesting possession, they just let England win it.
So instead of rushing in to make it a ruck, where you have the sort of stacks on the middle, the six or seven guys all pushing, no one came to help the Italian tackle?
No, absolutely not. They just stand back. They let England win it.
England would step over, grab the ball,
pick
themselves,
the ball up, and then off they go.
Right.
But then what would happen is England would get tackled, next phase.
Yes.
And they still wouldn't go in and contest possession. Now, at this point, this is where it's really interesting, there's no offside at this point. So it suddenly turns into AFL, where it's a 360 game.
Yeah.
And this is dead set. They were coming in from the back. So in rugby, basically, once a tackle's made, if you don't contest possession, it's what they call open play. We'll talk about open play in AFL in a minute. Mm-hmm. But they allowed open play to go on. And what that meant is they could come in from all angles. And the ref, brilliant as he was, just let it go. And England had no idea what to do. They didn't have adjust at all. So the Italians...
which is the British way, I suppose, not to adjust to...
Yeah, we're pretty...
Changes.
Yeah,
we're pretty, like queuing up and those sort of things.
Yeah, that's it. We're quite rigid. Yeah.
And so the imaginary offside line that's observed is only observed once there's a ruck or
two people come together.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
and
two
if that
people
doesn't
come together,
happen, it's blurred, and so you have to wait until the next time that happens.
Well, that's it.
Which means the Italians can run around the back.
Yeah, they just run around the back and pick the ball up. And they just it became and very similar to watch, I suppose, a game of AFL and the fact that guys are coming from all angles. That's exactly what was happening when England were in possession, because they were just coming around the back and they were doing all sorts of things, tackling guys from behind, picking the ball up wherever they were like, never committing to actually contesting possession. So it was kind of a dream for me, like a person who's lived in Melbourne for, you know, 14 years and then suddenly is watching a sport they grew up playing turn into AFL in 1 minute. It was absolutely fantastic.
Talking through the offside line, and it just happened.
Brilliant Daniel, I think that you've picked up on this and sent this in. Yeah, fantastic. Please keep them coming in. We'd love to, I guess, get some more observations from you guys on what's going on around the world, but from my perspective, but also, you know, what's going on locally as well.
Well, thank you, son Dan from Preston. I'd like to make special mention to Kieran from Watsonia, who fair dinkum has kept me honest, because he's... He has said, unbelievable. I feel like I'm really stiff. Yeah, exactly. So I'd said in one of our first episodes that Dunstall had kicked 17 down at Glenferrie. Now, shrewd as he is, he's written in to say that Dunstall was in fact 9 years old when Glenferrie was last used by the Hawthorn Football Club.
Do you think that was off the top of his head?
Let's hope so. Because, Kieran, if you've become a friend of ours, if you've got that sort of money off the top of your head.
That's brilliant.
And I suppose Jason was more likely to be kicking his 17 in the front yard of his parents' house when he was 9 years old. He did kick them out at Arctic Park at Waverley, which some of our very young listeners may just not know about at all. It was the coldest place in the world. A place where I was once there when the lights
went out. We did. We were there.
Yeah, that's right. With Simon Essendon, Luca. Essendon Hello St. to Simon if you're listening. Essendon St Kilda, that's right. They came back on a Thursday night or something and played.
Tuesday night they came. And the big...
15 minutes of...
The big controversy right. Because James Hurt didn't play that game.
But
then was allowed
him to
play the Tuesday game.
Yeah, and that's
then the AFL changed the ruling.
Yes, he's no foreigner to cheating anyway, is he?
We are off to a good start tonight, aren't we, guys?
Okay, so let's look at it. We're down to business, and look, in our early episodes, we tried to shape and attempt to show how essentially very early games of a ball being in dispute sort of became a thing in parklands where people were playing it. And while the game's sort of in its infancy, really, isn't it? But it's observed club by club, and they start to set up their own rules. Melbourne have got their own rules. Geelong, they've got their own rules. And effectively, it starts to become a thing that is not quite commonplace in terms of its rule setting, but... there's the offside line has been broken.
Yeah.
It sounds like the game now starts much like a rugby game, but after that, people sort of shift to positions out on wings and just ahead of what would be an offside line. The idea of the kick going forward and there being a mark and there being some form of open play exists. There's no hand pass, no throwing, and people are beginning to pick up the ball and run with it. There's also conjecture between two camps, the camp that were once from the Cambridge rules and the camp that were once from the rugby rules about what kind of ball we should have, and whether or not it should be a pick up and run with it or a dribble it along soccer style.
Yeah.
Ultimately, as we know, the rugby ball shape wins and the soccer dribbling style does not. And as those things begin to develop, so too do tactics. It is certainly the case that the guys who were into Cambridge were the people who were the sort of guys in the media.
Hamsley
and
Thompson.
Yeah, Hamsley and Thompson. They were advocating for a round ball game.
Absolutely.
But the bloke's doing the lion's share of the work on the Saturday afternoon. Wills, his cousin, and other like-minded creatures were all for picking the ball up, running fast, tackling, kicking it wide, and being sort of tactical about moving the game around a what becomes about a 200 metre in length field. From here, what we aim to investigate tonight, which is fascinating, is how tactics shape rules and then how rules shape tactics. It's back and forth, back and forth.
Yeah.
Captains make the decisions. Umpires sort of officiate here and there, and the media play a slight role, and eventually the public get involved. So it's the strategies and tactics that really attract our wondering tonight. The key quote that comes to me from Coventry's book is from Wills, and he asserts that the ground should be free to all so that the captain of each side could dispose of his forces in any position he likes. And of course, that's a beautiful dream. I think he sees that it can be the kick and mark game that we know and love today, but it doesn't wind up being an open, exciting piece of fanfare, does it, Finn? What happens? What's the sort of tactic that makes Carlton so successful through the 1870s as the game really begins to change?
I think it's something that would be so bizarre to the people that, our listeners that watch our game as we know it now. It's something called little marking. Now, this involved touching the ball kind of on your toes and basically throwing it to a teammate. So, yeah, just to kind of summarise, no minimum distance was stipulated for a mark. And look, this can be traced back, you know, to 1877 when the VFA came to fruition, where the ball had to travel 6 yards. This got changed throughout the decades, and finally when the VFL started, it was, you know, really firmly legislated that it had to travel 10 yards. But look, prior to that, it was, I guess, interpreted by umpires or captains. And look, Carlton devised this strategy kind of as a strategy against the holding the ball rule, which was introduced in 1874. Its players refused to kick long, kind of preferring instead to run with the ball short distances to one another, like a keepings off kind of a game.
And we're talking like a 1 meter kick, and sometimes not even a kick, like a I've touched it on my ball, on my foot.
So you touched it on your ball.
Nobody's playing that game.
So rather, I've touched the ball on my foot.
Yes, on your foot.
And I'm going to indicate that I've kicked it by effectively throwing it that meter.
Yeah.
A bit like you can throw the ball when handballing nowadays.
Yeah.
But the effect is that you can mark the ball by being an arm's length away. Is that about right?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, you're saying kick, which, I mean, you would, I guess, assume little marking, you have to kick to mark. But this was basically a touch and a little throw. And it should be noticed that a journalist, Alexander Sutherland, who was researched by James Coventry, that he said that it was actually one of the few parts of the game which a player had complete control.
Yeah, it's such a great line.
Yeah, it's a really great line. So, as the rule stipulated, no player shall cross his mark or encroach on this space by more than 4 or 5 yards when a mark is called, which is similar to now. I think it's 10 metres now the AFL has stipulated.
Yeah,
that.
They went bananas about it a few years ago. Remember, they were just paying 50s like it was a bodily function.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's gone now, and effectively you just got to have a safe space around you so that you can dispose the ball.
And that was there in the 1870s, and obviously this infuriated Harrison, who was coming to the end of, who had finished his career, and he was actually one of the creators of the 1866 rules, where, of course, which we talked about in previous episodes, the bounce of the ball, and he actually said that this would be nothing more than a gimmick, a blight on the game.
Yeah.
So he was completely against little marking.
You can see how
tactic.
That would happen. Yeah,
yeah, and I think we can bring that back to today's game, where there's certain, I mean, certainly Hawthorn comes to mind, that really skillful keepings off game.
Yeah.
Which, you know, wins your premierships.
Yeah,
which
exactly right.
Carlton absolutely dominated this part of the 1870s.
The early 1870s, yeah. Isn't it? And it appeals to me as the kind of thing that spectators don't want to go and watch. You're going to have to deal with an afternoon of watching the ball move bugger all so that a team can dominate play, which I suppose in a contemporary form is more like watching the ball kick backwards over and over and over and over until the crowd's so depressed that they don't want to cheer anymore.
Well, I'm sort of interested, Finny, like what your view is on how that would have been perceived, because it's not like it went on. So we talk about Hawthorn and the way they press, and Sydney the way they put numbers around the ball. There's things that have happened in the recent times and have been successful for those two teams, but this went on for like 30 years without anyone changing the rule, really. If it was that awful and people watching the game thought this was dreadful blight, it went on for quite a long time in my head.
It was similar to, I guess, the what we have now. You have teams that play the fast style, you have teams that play the more defensive style, and of course this is more a defensive strategy. Say, and we'll talk about Geelong
Swans brand.
Geelong, who like that open running style of play. This is something to stop that from occurring, and obviously Harrison hates it, who's a former Geelong player, hates this. So it's just to stop, I guess, a team strategy dominating. So you know what, we're going to do something else to stop that.
And to go back to that spectacle of it, the thing that's just happened in the late 1860s is that picking up the ball and running with it is the sexy thing now in football.
Very new.
And Harrison's fast.
Yeah, yeah.
He's the gun in the game. He's the one you turn out to watch. And all of a sudden, he's completely stymied by this 1 meter bullshit kick.
Yeah.
Mm.
And you can just imagine the guy thinking, I'm going to have to wait to get my chance to get into the game. The ball's going to have to be in dispute before I can do it. And
players like him, because he was coming to the end of career.
Yeah.
His career, but players like him.
And you can imagine the enormous frustration of the crowd if they've turned out to watch a champion play and they're playing Carlton, and the ball moves at, you know, the millimetre per second that they offer. But it's highly successful. It seems that when the VFA came to create, to I suppose homogenise a set of rules, mm-hmm. that they make recommendations to end this. Is that correct?
Yes. It does creep back in, because obviously, as Miller said, it, you know, it was there for 20, 30 years, so it worked. So we can, Mark Pennings does state that in 1877, the year that the VFA came in, that it had to travel for 6 yards, but he also states that it crept back in during the late 1880s, and it was pushed back to 2 yards. And then, you know, just there just has to be a clear space to separate the ball from a mark. And then finally in the VFL, 1897. So it took a long time for, I guess, the people who are officiating the rules, the people who are in charge, the players and the people who are watching, the audience, it took 25, 30 years for them to go, we don't want this anymore.
So yeah. Interesting, I think, the fact that the...
It's a slow process, obviously.
Well, yeah, but...
I guess compared to England in our first episodes, so small and tiny and quick, as opposed to centuries.
Yeah.
Mm.
Mm. It's interesting that, I don't know, I can't pick this one, whether there were so many rule changes going on around that time, and the 30 years before that when this was first happening, it took that long. Makes me think that it maybe wasn't that unpopular. I think next week's going to be really, really interesting when we get, for everyone listening, we get a special guest in. It's not just going to be us three.
Yes, that's right.
But the little mark was obviously abolished in 1897, which is the same year that a push from behind was outlawed as well.
Mm.
Might be able to discuss a bit more about that next week. But Finny, what are the, I suppose, tactical, I suppose, Well, it wasn't really, I was going to say coaches' kind of decisions, but it wasn't really coaches, really, was it? It was players making decisions that this was going to be the best way to play. Other things that you think had a massive influence on the game?
Yeah, absolutely. Because, of course, there was no, I guess, coaches. So, I guess, before the non-playing coach. So
yep.
Before the non-playing coach, it was pretty much up to the captains to organise team tactics and implement them on the field, etc. But during the 1880s, I guess some of the more progressive captains introduced kind of a rotation system, allowing the followers, or I guess to our younger listeners, our midfielders, to be rested in the pocket. Of course, there's no interchange at this point, anything yep. like that. 20 men to a side.
Big field, though. We're talking 200 by 150. It's a very big rectangle.
Big field. I mean, there are fields like that almost as large as that today. But most likely, this is to allow for greater strength and fitness in the later stages of games, which, you know, occurs now. Of course, we've got a 90 rotations a game, so coaches do have to do that now. But it seems to be the first evidence for me that in my research. And again, if any of our listeners pick up on this, it's on our Twitter handle at Origins of Footy.
Yes,
please correct us. But it's the first evidence of interchange of Australian footy, which was not officially introduced until 1978. And of course, this is different from the substitution or the 19th man, which was introduced in 1930.
Much like the soccer substitution, where exactly one player comes on, the other one goes off, and the game continues, and that's it. It's not any change in that sense. Yeah.
And I actually wanted to link this to Chris Conley, who was the coach of the Fremantle Dockers in 2002, and he introduced a young fitness coach called Adam Larkham, and he was keen to implement an up-tempo style of play, and he looked actually
from water polo.
He actually drew from a lot of sports, but the one that he kind of drew a lot of inspiration from was the NHL, so the National Hockey League in the States. And he noticed their intensity was created by heavily rotating the bench, and he theorized this
they're always
being
on.
Helpful in Perth,
yeah,
in the hot conditions and the hard surface. And he says, and this is James Coventry, that says, soft tissue injuries get injured when under fatigue. So if I can reduce fatigue by using rotations, maybe we could limit these injuries. So I think the non-playing coaches of the 1880s did actually highlight that our players were under fatigue, and if we do rest them at the latter stage of the half back then, we can actually, you know, get some intensity in. And Chris Conley, you know, did the same thing 120 years later, drawing inspiration from the States. And, you know, of course, Fremantle haven't won a premiership yet, but it was...
Yeah, a hell of a lot better than they did previously.
Absolutely. Though. I mean, I think it was... Oh, they were certainly in the finals the next year. And
it changes the face of the game, though, because you wind up now with 22 players who can effectively all get a 2 or 3 minute rest all the time. It sounds like, reading Conley's reflections, that he couldn't get the superstar midfielders to agree to it. They're like, what do you mean bring me off? I run for 30 minutes and I get 15 disposals a quarter. Thanks, champ. So I'll keep doing that and I get paid the most.
Yeah.
You go back to your... you know, little box coach. But as we know now, it is completely commonplace. And everybody, it seems like if you kick a goal, you have to run and take a seat on the bench. That's the rules.
Well, yeah, it went through that stage, didn't it, where it felt like goal kickers were the ones that were coming off the ground. I think now the game's become so anaerobic in that it's the level of intensity because of this, you know, discovery, really, that the expectation of those, you know, midfielders is... that you're going to work at this intensity, you know, that you're going to work an incredibly high level, a really, really high rate for this period of time, and then we're going to bring you off, you get your rest, and you're going to go on and do it again. You're not, you know, in a situation where you're going to have to run at a moderate intensity, let's say, for the whole game.
Yeah,
you've got to go and go and go and go, and then you're going to come back on. And it's, you know, this kind of, you know, tactic that's probably related to like a whole, I suppose, position that's having to change its... fitness capacity, really.
Absolutely.
So if we bring it back to 1877, all of a sudden, the game's been around for about 20 years, really, in a agreed sort of form. by this time, the VFA agreed to a certain set of rules, and one of the rules is, it's a new rule, the ball can't be handed, so you can't actually pass the ball like a present from you to another person.
Yeah.
So it means you actually have to strike the ball with your foot to move it on. The little mark is where the blurring takes place in you, because you touch it on your foot and then throw it, appearing to kick it, and the little mark takes place. But the VFA are very serious about saying it must not be passed. You cannot throw the ball or place it in another person's hands. And that really makes it, you can kick only. You can kick, you can dribble and so on, but it's really hard to comprehend, knowing what we know now, that there's no hand pass, no throw, no flick pass. The ball moves via foot. So as it goes, something has to combat this little marking. And it's only once the little mark itself is officiated that the open running style of play takes place. And that is essentially Geelong's time to dominate the competition, and that's just after the late 70s, and by about 1880 they're opening up a running style of play. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely. Because look, they felt the little marking, you know, it produced congestion, and that's what you know, the clubs that were using it, Carlton and Hotham / North Melbourne,
still criticising the congestion thing now.
Absolutely. And you know, just to quickly go on it with Geelong, again, Geelong's players were mainly boys in school or really fresh out of the colleges down in Geelong Grammar.
Oh, yeah, I've got that here in the book. And it says that 6 players a year would come from either Geelong Grammar or is it Geelong College?
Yep.
Yeah.
And they would enter Geelong Football Club, and because they were young men, they couldn't get into these scuffling, fierce body matches with men.
Absolutely.
So they should use the talents that they had, which was running, moving, and I suppose creating time and space to get the ball out wide and move it forward.
Yeah, and look, it was Wills and a couple with Hermann Reichmann, a German gymnast, who was down at Geelong Footy Club during this time. And basically, they produced a new approach where the attackers would slip away from the defenders and the wingers and the rovers would play kind of in the wide open spaces. So get the heavier ruck players to get into the packs and move it out wide, and then let the younger, slimmer, faster men take a more open style of play.
I'm interested in the idea, and it's mainly because it's still going on now, a lot of the rules that were, you know, talking about a very specific to a specific time, and that makes sense because of the fact that, you know, rule changes, players adapt and go, okay, we're going to do this. But there's a couple of things that we're going to talk about that maybe are still going on right this second. Time wasting is going on in all sorts of different sports. Absolutely. In a multitude of different ways, and it's still going on in AFL, if we're being honest about it. And it was incidents not too long ago, Liam Montagna standing in the goal square taking a month to kick a goal in the final quarter, guys trying to keep the ball for extended periods of time, kicking the ball backwards, things like that.
Mason Wooder as well, waiting the whole 30 seconds the game,
that was,
and allowing the siren
exactly right,
because you could see it on the scoreboard. The time wasting thing to me was very interesting because originally, the games didn't have a set time structure. In the 60s, they're playing until sundown, and if two goals haven't occurred, then we'll just come back the next week.
Yeah.
But once the VFA arrive, and we talk about, we'll probably talk about this in an episode later, that the VFA actually provide a fixture where you have games that are organised week to week. But previous to that, that didn't exist, and you could just return. And it's eventually Harrison, I think, who says,
There's got to be a time.
Yeah, we've got to get to a time by X time, whoever's in front, they win.
Mm.
Therefore, time wasting becomes a thing.
Absolutely.
it seems like always the case that the goal kick from the behind, the expectation was it went straight down the middle.
Yeah, absolutely. I've actually got an example here where it's the other way around. So clubs most likely just kick the ball out of bounds to waste time, you know, as they do now, even though there's a strict delivered out of bounds rule. But I've got an example here where it wasn't always the attacking side. So Mark Penning's side, Albert Park in 1877, seemed to be preoccupied with limiting the damage caused by Hoffman by kicking the ball out of bounds.
Well, they didn't want to lose by
They didn't want to lose by, you know, an insane amount of,
just
points.
Just on that, I'm going to go, well, where's Hoffman?
Hoffman is North Melbourne.
Right.
For those, named after our Premier. This particular game, the crowd assisted Albert Park by encroaching on the field.
Yes.
So the boundary line was much smaller. So it was really easy for them to time waste. So Hotham found it really difficult to score. So a team that should have, at the time, you know, completely annihilated was brought down to just...
Look, there's a couple of interesting rules that I just want to bring up. When the ball went out of bounds, during the VFA rules, the ball was thrown in at right angles from the boundary by the field umpire. So presumably they've got their back to the players.
Yeah.
And the ball has to hit the ground before it's in play. That's in fact how it works. So you can imagine the ball going out of bounds. Big, strong, you know, nasty player thinking, well, I'm going to knock this little Mancy boy. You know, I'm going to hack his shins and so on while the umpire's got his back turned.
Yeah.
And that becomes a real bone of contention all the way throughout league. The out-of-bounds rule, it still is now.
It is.
Really, and it changes the whole way. For the 150 years that the game's existed, it changes.
It does. And the big point where it changes, I think, is when they do change that throw-in, I guess the throw-in rule in 1906, where now it doesn't need to touch the ground. So a new tactic comes out, and a tactic called ruck shepherding, which is really interesting and something which our listeners will be a little bit familiar with. Basically, this tactic employed a player bumping or blocking an opponent's ruckman at the bounces or throw-ins to leave his ruckman, you know, free to take possession. I think the most famous of all ruck kind of shepherd combinations was South Melbourne's, of course, Roy Cazaly and Fred Fleeter. And this tactic is actually also responsible for the famous saying or song, Up There Cazaly. When Fleeter felt that Cazaly was in the clear, he would yell out, Up There Cazaly, to palm it down to the nearest follower. And I guess we can kind of link this to maybe the recently banned third man up rule, where, you know, basically the ruckman would almost shepherd each other and bring that up. And kind of because of this rule change, it led to a ruck contest in the air rather than a ground battle.
But kicking in the ruck is a different idea, Finn. It separates, for years, decades even, South Australia and Victoria.
This one I find so interesting. And James Coventry just absolutely smashes this one out. It's actually, so for our listeners, kicking in the ruck, it's actually something that resembles the modern kicking in danger rule. And I guess
so scrimmage is what we mean by ruck, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Yes. And a ruck is that.
It's a rugby term, isn't it? It's the idea of a you know, any contested possession involving physical contact. Yeah, the term ruck at that point, where this rule was probably introduced, is quite different to the idea of ruck, what we see it now in NFL.
Absolutely. So, yeah, but 1905, I guess, the South Australians decided to outlaw this practice. Which, you know, would, which they didn't know at the time, which would vastly produce a different style of play to that of the Victorians, who felt this rule didn't need to be abolished because there was, you couldn't hack.
So they felt like outlawing kicking vigorously if the ball
when
is
when you're
within.
Going down to pick up the ball.
Yes.
Now, that's not hacking. So if we can bring it back, hacking is something where someone's got They can either have possession of the ball themselves or not, and you just go at them with their legs. The South Australians were able to pick up the ball without fear of having their fingers kind of broken off, which, as a side note, which we'll discuss in future episodes, which in turn would foster actually the proliferation of the handball.
Yes.
Because they played, which was known as the flick pass in South Australia, which was almost as quick as a throw.
And they sort of begin to play like a more beautiful style of
football. Yeah, a more open, just because of, they didn't want their hands completely kicked off. And I guess this new rule proved counterproductive when playing against Victoria. And doing a bit of research on Time and Space by James Coventry, I kind of discovered that it would be reasonable to assume that the South Australians would be less inclined to play in the packs, as the Victorians would naturally kind of kick at their opponent's hands whilst picking up the ball. In fact, I think James Coventry actually described South Australia as skilled but somewhat soft, while Victoria was vigorous, bordering on violent.
The two Victorian somethings.
Yeah.
So you two seem very happy with that comment. I don't know.
We do, because you can just imagine that, if the ball's, in a scrimmage and you're trained to play in a certain way, so I don't need to go, I can kind of go down and pick up that ball without fear of getting my hands kicked off. And then you're playing a team that you know plays by a different set of rules where they kick someone's hands if they go down and pick up the ball.
Yeah.
You're not. I wouldn't be pumped about going in hard.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, everyone, for tuning in tonight. The wonderful part of investigating this game and the game that we know and love is that it's not just by chance. All of these things exist because of tactics. The rules become commonplace because of the tactic. And then the new tactic is worked against the new set of rules all the way until 1897, where the VFL becomes a new league, a breakaway league, and they're using a set of rules that are almost the same as the VFA, and then there's a huge battle for how that works. But rules themselves are something that we still don't really understand. There's also a set of interpretations that we don't understand either, and they're the things that frustrate us on a Saturday. When you're watching the footy on a Saturday, make sure that you tweet into our Twitter handle, at Origins of Footy. Make sure you write into our Gmail account, which is originsoffooty@gmail.com, and your opportunity there to follow us on Facebook at One Game at a Time. And thank you so much to my wonderful friends here, Finn O'Sullivan.
Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you to Ryan Miller.
Thank you. Good work tonight, gents.
Work on those one putts. And we'd just like to implore all of you to not get ahead of yourselves and take it one game at a time.